So before I begin my actual talk, I would like to thank the KITP and previously known as the ITP for its continued support of planet formation and extrasolar planet programs. This is the fourth one I've been to. And also to thank the organizers of this particular program and conference for organizing such a conference which demonstrates how far our field has progressed. So, let me first of all get to the beginning of my talk. And okay, so I'm going to, as stated, tell you about giant planet formation and the core accretion model. I will very briefly touch on some of the observations that I think provide the most key constraints to the modeling of giant planets. Then I am going to talk about core nucleated accretion, core accretion model. Give you a little bit of an overview of it. Talk about disks, giant planet masses. Basically, I'm going to focus on two major new developments where we've refined two stages. And one is how interactions with the disks end up determining giant planet masses. And the other is how the opacity in the growing planet's atmosphere affects the speed at which it is able to cool and therefore accrete, and the amount of solids you need to get the gas runaway. So, planet formation basics. You know the basics of dynamics, flat solar system, disk, etc. Compositions, largest bodies are the most gas rich. That's the clear one saying there's something a little different and certainly pointing to the start with something solid, add gas. I like to show this because the 3D appearance really shows you that the giant planets are a lot bigger than the terrestrial planets. And this has 8. Planets are still small compared to the sun. Another key observation is the minor components of the giant planets, but major components of Uranus and Neptune, the so-called ice giants. And this is a plot which shows the total heavy elements in blue, the portion of those heavy elements in the core in red. And this was compiled by two people who are in this room. There's not a lot of uncertainty in Uranus and Neptune because they are primarily heavy elements. Jupiter and Saturn, there's a lot of uncertainty, as Dave discussed earlier, especially with Jupiter, because it's such a large fraction of hydrogen and helium. Circumstellar disk, typical gas mass, the mass of the disk, a few percent, the star's mass, the lifetime, less than 10 million years. Those are the keys, and probably just a few million years in most cases. So, whereas you can make terrestrial planets after the gas leaves, you need the gas around to form giant planets because it's their primary constituent, and need to form planetesimals, of course, before the gas takes the dust away. This is the way I like to plot the abundance of exoplanets on a logarithmic plot. And those two bars over on the left, those are actual points there. They don't fit on this scale because I like factors of two in mass. But you can see a peak and then it tails off over to the left. And actually, if you did a giant planets versus metallicity, it wouldn't look that different. But the peak, there's a real drop off at high mass. Those are easier to observe, difficult to observe at small mass. And the fact that it gets more and more difficult to observe at small mass suggests that there really is a dip. Not a lot of objects in the 25 to 100 Earth mass range. It's not as deep as the Brown Dwarf Desert, but it still seems awfully significant. I won't go into this, the metallicity, planet frequency, heard a lot about. And we're getting wonderful data from exoplanets, as you can see right here. Bill allowed me to use this Kepler data. So anyway, what are the key findings? Well, there are a lot of interesting things that have been found. Discuss them in great detail. But the ones that I think are the most key for subject of giant planet formation is that there aren't a lot of planets more massive than Jupiter. There are more giant planets around stars with more metal. And the mass radius relationship between planets is grossly similar to our solar system. There are the inflation, et cetera, but by this I mean the planets of Saturn, Jupiter mass seem to be dominantly, with one likely exception, made of hydrogen helium. The 20 Earth mass planets seem to have a few Earth masses of gas, hydrogen, helium, but are dominantly heavy elements. And there's indications from Corot 7b that when you get down to 5 Earth masses or so, you start getting solid bodies. Though that's a little bit very tentative because that's a very close-in planet. Okay. So, let's go into the theory. Okay, you all know this. It's been known for 2.5 centuries. The planets form in a disk around the sun. Planets common around single stars. And planetesimal hypothesis. Heard about planetesimals. But the planetesimal hypothesis, as extended by Viktor Safronov, who was here at that first planet formation program the ITP had, is that planets grow by accretion of solid bodies. However, you make planetesimals. That's been a concern, but I think Anders' talk shows some progress in that area and some very promising venues. But you start with planetesimals. You accrete them into terrestrial planets by collisions, gravitationally enhanced collisions. And in the case of giant planets, according to the core nucleated accretion model, you basically build a big enough terrestrial planet while the gas is still around that the planet starts accumulating gas. Okay, so the modern models of core accretion, which have been done by several groups in various different countries, but they're very basically mostly similar to the Pollock et al. Model. You have a runaway of solids early on. Solid line is solids. Dotted line is gas. Dot dash line is total mass of the planet. It's a function of time. You have the embryo formation, the runaway. You have the embryo isolated from other planetesimals for the most part. Cools off, is able to gradually accumulate gas. When the gas mass is about equal to the solids mass, the rate of gas accumulation gets much, much faster and runs away, and then truncated somehow. But that wasn't, the exact details weren't simulated there. So what I want to spend a lot of my talk on is some new work on this phase, the embryo isolation phase. But before I do that, I want to go into this region where you get Jupiter and why Jupiter is Jupiter's mass. What might explain the masses or mass distribution of giant planets? So, this is a simulation done 7 years ago by Matthew Bate and his colleagues. And he put planets of various masses in a disk, had them gravitationally interact with the disk material, and saw what happened. When you have a Jupiter mass planet, you have a gap. Although in this case, it's not a complete gap. Something gets through. More gets through. It's not such very complete. At Saturn, at around 30 Earth masses, you have a significant perturbation. You're seeing some perturbation at 10 and 3, and very little at one Earth mass. So, together with Gennaro D'Angelo, joined our planet formation group, we have run some simulations which use constraints from similar models that Gennaro and Steve Lubo and Matthew Bate have developed. And these are with Gennaro's code, the particular ones that we use, on how the planet can get material delivered to it in the late phases. And we've run them with the basic case, and we found that we got something a little different than the planets that, the distribution of planets that were seen. And therefore, we've changed the physical parameters as inputs to better match the distribution. So now this is not the whole disk. This is just focusing in on the region of the planet within the planet's Hill sphere. And these are the initial positions. These are the trajectories of bodies. The blue bodies are the ones that stay with the planet. The golden ones go off, come in, go out, the regions where there's flow. And we found that only about the inner quarter hillsphere radius. It's not exactly symmetric, but our models of the thermodynamics of the giant planet require a spherical object, spherical approximation, which previously was used as one hillsphere, but this suggests that a quarter hillsphere is a better approximation, and that's what we're using now. This is just a 3D visualization. Now, the other key aspect that we've gotten from including the interactions with the disk is the maximum rate at which the disk can feed gas to the planet. There are two limiting factors. There's in planet's accretion of gas. One is the planet's ability to hold on to the gas. And when a planet is small, it doesn't have a lot of gravity, thermal energy, the gas just goes away. You have a little gas, and it gives a pressure gradient which pushes out and prevents the accretion of more gas. But when the planet is a little bit bigger, when it gets the teenage stage, it'll consume everything that you put near it. And the disk decides that it's not going to put everything near it. This is, in two cases, a high viscosity case and a lower viscosity case, the maximum amount of gas that can be fed to the planet. And it does increase with the planet's mass up to around a Saturn mass, a little more in the high viscosity case, a little less in the low viscosity case, because the planet's gravity is what's pulling the gas in. But then the gap clearing takes over, and at higher masses, you start dropping off on accretion rates. So you have a flow that peaks near Saturn, drops sharply, in this case, at around Jupiter. In this case, it takes longer. So I'm going to show you variations in planet growth, the same as what I showed from the Pollock et al, except in addition to the early stages, I'm going to show you the later stages. This is a model which is very similar to the Pollock et al. All of these models are very similar to the Pollock et al, except for a shorter time scale, because the atmosphere is assumed to have a lower dust opacity based on some simulations that Morris Podolak and colleagues have done. When I show you the second set of calculations, they actually self-consistently compute the dust opacity in the atmosphere. And so there will be changes here, but they've only been done for this part. So these depend on how big the planet is in terms of its hillsphere. Turns out it doesn't much matter what fraction of the hillsphere occupies, whether the temperature, when we change the temperature a little bit in these, doesn't make much of a difference, temperature of the disk. Having the disk gradually lose material as we do in the three runs doesn't have much effect early on. So you get this gradual growth, this gas runaway and total mass runaway at around 2.5 million years. And then I'm going to tell you a little more about the models when I focus in on this period. So the radius is again, goes up. In that period where there's the runaway, it peaks, then it goes very far down. Okay, now I'm focusing in on the later period and talking about the mass going up. And in our old models, we just kind of cut it off. There was no particular disk physics. Well, all of these, then we put in a, what if the disk takes the material away? Are you going to run out of gas? No, doesn't work. What if the disk is lower in mass in general and drops in mass? Well, there's no reason for there to be a peak in the planets at Jupiter. The only way we could get a peak, a nice smooth cutoff, where it spends some time near Jupiter, where it's not coincidental that the nebula just gets removed rapidly for at the right time, is for our low viscosity case, where there's a low viscosity in the nebula, alpha of a few times 10 to the minus 4, at the planet formation epoch. Doesn't mean when the major accretion occurs, it can't be higher. But this, in order to match most planets being around Jupiter, you need these lower viscosity disks. I think I'm going to, in the interest of time, skip over the planet's radius. There's a peak in luminosity, but when we do some more realistic models with the gradual tail off, the luminosity, and this is again the preferred model, the gold one here, this is the integrated luminosity, but that means since there's no extremely sharp slope, the peak is nowhere near as big. And the planet's mass, you do have this instability, but it doesn't just stop at one point. It gradually tails off as the planet is clearing material from around it and as the disk is gradually dissipating. If the disk wasn't dissipating, you'd still have a continued gradual accretion. And this is just a different view of the most realistic case now, showing not an immediate, not just going off with nowhere to stop, but also saying where things stop. And the radius of the planet gets big and drops down to around 2 Jupiter radii fairly soon. If we had inflated planets that were bigger than about 2 Jupiter radii, that would be a problem if you need to just keep them big, because they don't start that big. Luminosity, again, you have this spread over a larger region. You have about the same luminosity because you have the same amount of energy that you have to get out. Radius gets big, gets small. But I want to get to, I don't want to dwell on this because I want to talk a little bit about some models that we've done very recently that are not yet published, where we've included some more physics in the atmosphere. In particular, we're including coagulation and settling of grains within the planet's atmosphere. And the reason this is key is the problem with formation of a very massive envelope is that as gas comes in and planetesimals come in, they bring energy, that makes it hot, that gives a thermal pressure pushing upward. If the opacity is lowered, more radiation can get out. The planet can shrink and allow more material to come within its gravitational reach and accrete more rapidly. These models aren't going to do the later phase of the disk. We decided not to do that because that can just couple with the ones that I showed you a few minutes ago. So we are actually simulating coagulation of grains in the atmosphere, and we use three different values of surface density. The first part hasn't changed much. This is the Pollock et al. Like phase one, this core runaway. The cooling phase, though, it's much shorter. In Pollock et al., it was around 6 million years. In the simulations where we reduced the opacity to 2% of the interstellar value of dust, it was a little over 2 million years. Here, it's about 400,000 years. Very rapid formation. This is with about a 10 gram per square centimeter solid surface density at 5 AU. Now, that's about corresponding to 3 or so times the minimum mass, what you get by grinding up the solids in each planet and spreading them out, the annuli, to the next planet. Very rapid. So we looked at, what if you get 6 grams per square centimeter? Well, it takes a little longer, but still a reasonable length of time. 4 grams per square centimeter. Longer, but still not totally unreasonable. Much smaller, much shorter time for a given surface density, but also for a given time, you can use a smaller surface density and the amount of solids in the planet, in the core, scale as the 3/2 power of the surface density. So the core can be less than half as big as the models, which just assume for ad hoc reasons a dust opacity that was either based on the solar interstellar grain opacity or 2% the interstellar grain opacity. If you actually model the opacity, you get this settling down, particles rain down, it's clear, the radiation can get out, planet forms quickly. This shows the luminosity going off, but that again will tail out because of the disk effects. This is for a few people in the audience who are familiar with opacities. The key area is the radiative region, but you get opacities which are down here, whereas it's around here for interstellar grains. Very, very clear. And the gas opacities we leave as full gas opacities, but they're only important around here. And this is in a different situation for this low mass disk. But it's at the bottom of the radiative region, the opacity is much less. Okay, so I wanted to just give, maybe to promote discussion, some comparison between the models. Because of time, I'm going to skip over mostly the 2 year ago, but there's red, which means it's a problem, real problem. Green means it's good. And things have gotten better, gotten a lot less red. Still have it here, the fragmentation, the mass gap. The brown dwarf desert just is the kind of was the end of the direct collapse planets are like binary stars model. But the rapidity and core size were the biggest questions in the core nucleated accretion model. I think that for the most part, we've taken care of those. You're going to hear about the disk instability model right after lunch. And I think that works. That is certainly a stronger model in cases far from the star. And we've seen a planetary-like system far from star. And that's difficult here. The only difficulty that, the greatest difficulty for gravitational instability is why haven't we seen anything bigger? But anyway, I just want to wrap up by saying that according to the core nucleated accretion model, giant planets took a few million years to form. These young planets are quite luminous, and we've been at this conference focusing on observing planets. But observing protoplanets is also something that's going to be very important. Observing the really young planets, not just the ones that still have their accretion heat and are gradually cooling, but the ones that are still growing, are really hot, may be episodically accreting on shorter time scales. Don't know, but this is an important area where I think observations of young disks are going to be advancing things in the next few years. And we'll also tell by when we get a population of these and can get some statistics, that may discriminate among giant planet formation models and planet disk interaction models. I think there's another area, the interaction with giant planet formation and the formation of their moons. And just saying that Kepler will greatly expand our data on both terrestrial and giant planets, although I'm afraid it's not going to give images quite as nice as what I showed earlier. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Jack, Sean Raymond. I was wondering, for your case where you're able to asymptotically get Jupiter's mass right, in that same type of disk, what do you get for Saturn? Are you able to get Saturn as well?
We have not worked on the multi-planet problem. We could adjust things to make it work. But what we really want to do is get a disk where we have the full interactions between the planets. And that's a much more complicated problem. It's on our list, but it's not the first thing on our list. The first thing on our list is working on the early phase of growth, the runaway accretion of solids part. And this is probably the second or third thing on the list.
Dave Bennett, you mentioned in your survey of the planet, giant planet results, that you thought there was this deficit of planets in the sort of Neptune to Saturn mass range. But in fact, microlensing seems to show that planets in the Neptune to Saturn mass range are actually more common than any class of planets that have been detected with radial velocities. Now, possibly, we're looking at a different sample of stars, tend to be low mass, and we're looking out further, sort of well beyond the snow line. But it does seem to contradict the original assumption.
Well, I think that you have pretty small statistics right now, at least the published microlensing planets.
Yeah, but the discrepancy is still significant, even with the small statistics.
Okay.
Anders Johansson, Jack, when you accrete gas into the Hill sphere, does it enter a circumplanetary disk? And if yes, do you need viscosity to get the gas from the circumplanetary disk onto the surface of the planet?
When we do it, we are, well, first of all, there's a time when it's not going to enter a disk. Because anything, it will hit the planet because the planet's big. Once the planet shrinks, then clearly it's going to hit the disk. But our model has focused on the thermal aspects and the feeding of gas. We have not modeled the material's transport within that disk to the planet. But yes, viscosity, certainly you're going to need viscosity, whether you can get all of the, you might get all the viscosity you want from turbulence caused by new material falling onto the disk.
Hi, Ed Thomas. Just to get back to the effects of multiple planets, I just wanted to comment on that a little bit, because we've looked at that, and it's actually very interesting. I mean, it turns out that aside from the obvious thing that you expect from multiple planets, that you get interactions that raise your eccentricities. Also very important is this idea of competitive accretion among planets, which actually turns out to be really critical for setting the masses and for setting the sometimes somewhat stochastic distribution of masses. So that's one thing. Another, the second point is the masses of Jupiter and Saturn. What we find is that this is very likely the result of the disk sort of being in the last gasps as Jupiter and Saturn are forming. So Jupiter kind of gets a reasonable complement of gas. Saturn is significantly starved already, and Uranus and Neptune are just out of luck. And sorry, one third point to make, you put the green category for gravitational collapse for maybe making HR 8799. Just wanted to say that we can actually add that to the core accretion column also, because we can make those by core accretion, which I will explain tomorrow.
Okay. I put the HR 8799 in a neutral color for the gas instability, and certainly with small enough grains, small enough bodies dragging in, you can make giant planets via core accretion out there if you have the right conditions. So I think that's a very open question, because I think both of the models have capabilities of making planets out there.
I'm not crazy enough to try to actually make them out there. I will cheat.
You move them out there.
And move them, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there may be ways to make them out there.
Oh, okay. Now that's really ambitious.
But I don't say I'm necessarily going to believe those ways. Just like we were, Bodenheimer et al., and I was part of the all part, made giant planets at 0.05 AU, but we said we didn't believe it. And I don't know how believable it will be. Have to do the simulations to see how much disbelief in terms of parameter ranges you have to go to.
Christiane Helling, University St. Andrews. There has been this discussion if GQ-Lupe was a planet or a brown dwarf, and it basically was hinging on the determination of the mass. And I seem to remember that one of the issues was here the initial conditions for these kind of simulations you just and I was wondering if you kind of could put the simulations you presented in relation to the Wuchtal and whatever his collaborator was, model which was used to determine the mass of GQ-Lupe.
Okay, I am not familiar enough with that model to really state that. But this model, there is nothing sacred about any particular mass limit. you would expect a tail off, which is gradual, and exactly where it is depends on the conditions in disks, especially the viscosity.
Chris Mordazzini, for something about the microlensing, I think as a remark, I think when you try to correct for the observational bias, this their findings are still in accordance with this kind of minimum, maybe at higher masses than mentioned, perhaps 30 to 100 Earth masses. So I don't think that is a problem. But then another point, when this formation timescales now become so short because of the reduced opacities, and then you look at distribution of metallicities and disk masses, you will have many, many disks which have a sufficient solid surface density to form giant planets, a really, really large fraction, much more than we observe giant planets, actually. And they're going to form very early, so they're going to probably migrate. So you expect, I would estimate you expect much more hot Jupiters than the 0.5% we actually observe. Maybe they get all destroyed, but that is certainly an issue to look at.
Yeah, I think those are important issues. I think that the success of some... Well, first of all, I think that when we do the first stage right, we are not going to get as efficient accretion. And that will take longer and be less efficient and require us to go up a little bit and lose some of our advantage in terms of lowering the surface density of the nebula, although keeping the core small, because that's all we need. So that probably is going to stay, because the opacity will be lower. Modeling of the dust coagulation, it's the first physical models of this, and they're fairly good models, but it's a very complex process. So saying that we really know what's going on is overstating the case. As far as forming a lot of, so that answers part of your question. The early successes of models explaining exoplanets via displaced formation from current presence, I think, has led to an irrational exuberance in the field of planetary displacement, and that subsequent observations have shown that many planets stay where they are. And there is something a little bit strange about when you put in the standard models of migration. And Steve Lubo will talk about some of the more recent models and the uncertainties and things. But it can certainly have a significant effect on giant planet formation, as Alibert and colleagues have shown. And I think though there are some very important effects, and eventually we're going to have to look at the migration and the, if nothing else, on the formation epoch, the relative migration of solids versus gas, especially when you have competing bodies, will be very important.
My question is somewhat along the same lines. If you put aside migration for the moment, are there any clear implications of the core accretion model as it now stands for both the abundance and actually the mass of the giant planets in around M stars versus, say, G stars versus A stars? I mean, do you expect a systematics there?
The problem there is that for the models to say a lot about them, you need really to have that it's based on what the different properties of the disks around those stars are. Yeah, we know something about it, but we probably don't know. I don't feel I know enough about it to really comment on it. So that's the problem, for from my perspective.
Matyachuk. So Jim Pollack thought that the collapse of the envelope might have something to do with the capture of irregular satellites. Did you look into that at all? Do you think there is a connection? And
yeah.
Comment?
We looked at it, and we found that it doesn't seem to work, at least in the standard way. And that's actually the paper we published in Icarus last year. We have a section on the implications, because in the Pollack, this is actually Peter Bodenheimer's model. Jim Pollack and colleagues did this work in 1979 based on models, the then current models by Peter Bodenheimer, in which you had a very rapid collapse on the time scale of a few years of the envelope. And while we have a, let's see if I can get to it. We have fairly quick shrinkage of the planet. So the planet drops in radius from the region of the irregular satellites rapidly on, let's see, this is not going to be the best one because this is the radius versus mass. Let's see if I have luminosity. Okay. It drops rapidly on this time scale. But this is a million year time scale, and you look at this, and this is like thousands of years instead of like years. And so if you get the irregular satellites coming in, they will decay down, and the parameter space, cross-section parameter space for which it works is a lot smaller.
We can have a short question if we can have also a short answer. Okay?
It's just a quick comment. I mean, I guess you showed nicely that in order to naturally limit growth to a border of Jupiter mass, you need to assume a relatively low disk viscosity. I think your paper said of order 10 to the minus 5 for an alpha value. And just to comment quickly that if you want to form giant planets by any mechanism in a more massive disk, that constraint probably becomes even more stringent.
I think a few times 10 to the minus 4, not 10 to the minus 5. So it's a factor of 30 less, and not that far away. But
okay, thank you very much.
I want to call people's attention to the fact that the posters are now outside in the sun.